This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Inside Story on BFM 89.9.
Good evening. You're listening to Inside Story with Sharmila Ganesan and Lee Chui Lin. Tonight, we're marking Malaysia Day by asking, what would have happened if MA63 was properly implemented?
So first, we look at how this would have changed the social and cultural landscape of Sabah and Sarawak. And then we discuss what might have happened politically, both within the states and in Malaysia overall.
Tell us, are you optimistic about Malaysia's direction? Are we living up to our potential? You can call 7733-2900, WhatsApp or voice note 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. This is Inside Story. It is 6:07, and a quick historical primer. The Malaysia Agreement, or MA63, was the legal agreement signed in July 1963 that brought together North Borneo, now called Sabah, Sarawak, and Singapore with the existing states of the Federation of Malaya. And that resulting union, of course, became known as the Federation of Malaysia. Now, under MA63, Sabah and Sarawak were deemed as equal partners to the former Federation of Malaya. And it's actually considered an international agreement registered by Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And this means that the Malaysian Parliament doesn't have the authority to amend the terms of MA63. Now, this was very important for Sabah and Sarawak because it laid out the conditions under which the Federation of Malaysia was established. And this is where it gets really important. It gave Sabah and Sarawak a high degree of autonomy within this new federation. For instance, they had control over immigration so that a Malaysian citizen from outside the states can be denied entry. Now, that's still in practice. However, there are a number of things that I think in the implementation and since haven't necessarily been given as much importance as they should be, which often tends to come up when we talk about the relationship between, quote-unquote, the former Federation of Malaya and Sabah and Sarawak.
Yeah, so some of this has to do in general with the power tussle or the question of autonomy between the federal government and state governments, which every state has to contend with in some form or another. I think where it gets sticky for Sabah and Sarawak is because of the agreement in which, from the very beginning, this issue of autonomy was front and center. So it was always part and parcel of what the relationship should have been. And also because of the word equal partners, which is, again, a sticking point that has emerged very, very often. But the other, perhaps most important, maybe, part of why this question of autonomy between state and federal governments becomes so important is because of their natural resources and their infrastructural needs and the ways in which one element of that has been heavily used. One has heavily benefited the country, and the question of whether or not those benefits have then been seen equally spread back in to invest in and develop the states.
So there have been a number of recent attempts to, I suppose in some ways, look back at that MA63 agreement and retool it or bring it up to date, perhaps. And so in 2019, a proposed constitutional amendment to the MA63 agreement was made to change Sabah and Sarawak from states back to being territories, but that vote failed in Parliament. And then on December 23rd last year, the bill to amend some of the articles in the federal constitution to give greater recognition to MA63 was passed in the Dewan Negara, and this received the approval of the Agong on January 19th this year. We haven't yet seen what that might eventually result in. But I think with the elections coming as well, there have been a fair amount of, I think a fair number of conversations, overtures happening to Sabah and Sarawak as well. Because, I mean, politically speaking, though, despite what was or not delivered, Sabah and Sarawak have always been really important when it comes to their vote bank.
Yes. And that also has been, I'm going to use the word sticking point again, but that has also been another sticking point, I think, not just politically, but sometimes in the ways in which we speak about our countrymen.
Yes.
Because that's the other element here, right? Like if we're going to be talking about the relationship between the, as you put it, the former Federation of Malaya or Peninsula Malaysia and Sabah and Sarawak, then it's also you know, it's kind of, I wouldn't say it's fraught, but whenever it is that we talk about Sabah and Sarawak issues here on the show or around Malaysia Day, the question always comes up whether or not we are in fact equal, whether we even think of ourselves as equals, whether we think of ourselves as equally Malaysian. And those are all things that are sticky and need to be teased out, I think. But I do believe that if we don't come to some form of greater parity or some form of greater understanding, that overall, it's not going to work as we move forward.
So go with us on a bit of a journey today. What we're doing is asking, what might it be like if MA63 was upheld effectively? We are going to be looking first at the social, cultural impacts of that. But let us know if you'd like to weigh in. Are you optimistic about Malaysia's direction? Are we living up to our potential? You can call 7733 2900, send us a voice note at 018-789-8899, or WhatsApp us there as well. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio. After this, we'll be speaking with Dr. Vilashini Somia, anthropologist and senior lecturer at the University of Malaya. So keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9. It's 6:14. You're listening to Inside Story with Sharmila and Lynn. And tomorrow is Malaysia Day. So we are looking at ME63 and discussing what it might be like. What might Malaysia be like if it was implemented properly? So weigh in. Are you optimistic about Malaysia's direction? Are we living up to our potential? You can call us 7733 2900, voice note us or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Joining us now is Dr. Vilashini Somia, anthropologist and senior lecturer at University of Malaya. Dr. Vila, good to have you with us.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
So let's start by setting the stage a bit. What's the significance of September 16th to the people of Sabah and Sarawak?
Well, if you are just Malaysian in general, September 16 is a very big day, in fact, right? I think there's a lot of focus on Merdeka, National Independence Day. But Malaysia Day is a very special day, right? Because it's the day that North Borneo, previously what Sabah was named, Sarawak, agreed to sort of form a sovereign nation together with Malaya and at that time Singapore. So, you know, Malaysia Day is in a sense sort of a celebration, right, to commemorate the establishment of the Malaysian Federation.
And since we're going to be using MA63 as a framework for the rest of our chat today, What place does MA63 hold in the history of Malaysia, yes, but also Sabah and Sarawak and how it's talked about?
Well, it's a very significant piece of document. ME63 is, of course, as you know, the Malaysian Agreement of 1963, and it's basically the entire framework is designed. ME63 was designed to really sort of inform, I think, in the design of the Malaysian Federation of several key points of what it meant to be equal partners in this federation, right? So you have things in which you sort of come together, really the bridging of an entire new nation, but at the same time paying homage to very, very key, significant, sociocultural practices and needs of Sabah Sarawak. And this would include, having control over the local immigration laws in Sabah and Sarawak, right? A Borneoization of the local civil service is another very good example. Also the issue of representation. Sabah and Sarawak, according to the ME63, was supposed to have representatives in the federal government proportionate to its population. So, there are 20 points that the Sabah territory and 18 points that the Sarawakian territory came up with in ME63 catered for both territories in coming together to forming the nation.
Now, all this was supposed to give Sabah and Sarawak a high degree of autonomy, right, in what was supposed to be the Federation of Malaysia. Mm-hmm. What would this have entailed, and have we seen this autonomy materialize?
Not really. And I think this is why, it's on many levels, it's been politicized by local politicians in both Sabah and Sarawak, right? That while the original ME63 had a structure that was you know, dignified and, you know, completely workable, over time, the value of MA63 eroded. Essentially, what it meant was that from being equal partners, Sabah and Sarawak were then reduced to mere states within Malaysia. And when I do talk about this with people, if we would have, if the original document was upheld in which Sabah and Sarawak were equal partners, what we are looking at is what, say, Perlis is to Malaysia would be the same as to what Kuching is to all of Sarawak, right? The entire idea is actually very mind-blowing to, I think, somebody who's hearing it for the first time. But essentially, that's what it meant. It would mean that equal opportunities are afforded. It would mean that resources would be split equally amongst the territories rather than amongst states.
So in an everyday sense then, how different might life be in Sabah and Sarawak if the spirit of MA63 had been followed?
You know, when I was much younger, many people, I always consider myself in a position of privilege. I have education, I have a parent. My father is not Sabahan. He is from the peninsula. So I had the best of both worlds. I could sort of travel and sort of, you know, normalize for me an understanding traveling between Sabah and Sarawak. But for many people in both Sabah and Sarawak, this is a privilege. And when they do visit parts of the peninsula, you know, a stirring happens deep inside, that you realize that there's so much by way of progress and development that they do not have. And that's a very important first thing that's always noticed, because this translates to a lot of basic needs, roadworks, hospitals, schools, right? In a sense, I think when people do talk about ME63 today, there is this sense that if we had upheld the way in which we understood equal partnership, if the territories were recognized as equal partners in the forming of the Malaysian Federation, then these sort of disparities in growth and progress would not be so apparent when one were to visit the city centre in Kuala Lumpur, for example.
I'm going to bring up Project IC, which was allegedly aimed at permanently increasing the Muslim population in Sabah and, of course, undertaken during Tun Mahathir's tenure. Now, this resulted in an unregulated influx of foreigners in the 90s and is said to have drastically changed Sabah's ethnic composition. Talk to us about how this has impacted the state today from a sociocultural perspective.
Well, if we were to use very politicized narratives, then we'd be talking about the issue by way of distinctions, separations, insider-outsider languages, right? The villainizing of the, you know, stranger danger and so on and so forth. But from a social science perspective or an anthropological perspective, what we actually look at here is the failure to develop, I think, potential, human potential. What it means is that while it was completely used, or at least allegedly used, for the benefits of a status quo, political ideology, and so on and so forth, it means that you have an entire foreign population or non-citizen population essentially living very squalid lives, right? They don't have access to a lot of things. Education, healthcare, so on and so forth. And when they do, it's because it's through the manipulation of structures, right? It's through the manipulation of documentation. On the flip side, though, if we were to discuss the issue of Project IC and its impact on society at large in Sabah, you would also see great suffering coming from the indigenous community in itself. And as an anthropologist, I can tell you, when we do talk about Project IC, it's really not about siding with a foreign population or indigenous population. It's recognizing that you're looking at an oppression of both the indigenous and the non-citizen communities, the irregular migrant communities, in which, you know, it's two ends of the same spectrum. Essentially, what that means is that solving the problem becomes so much harder. And this brings it back to ME63, because when you don't have autonomy from a federal government, when you don't have the ability to sort of decide for yourself these immigration laws, or, you know, or the kind of documents you can give out for, you know, general amnesty, then it makes it very difficult for people to look for solutions.
On that then, there's also been a broader conversation about the representation and centering of Indigenous cultures and languages, or a lack thereof, really, for instance, in the education and media sectors. What can you tell us about this?
Well, you know, I believe that the Indigenous community has been struggling for decades at this point to sort of prove a point that they are contributing, incredibly deserving members of the country, in which they need to be recognized, they need representation. They certainly have rights by way of the Bumiputra framework. However, I think for many of them, because they, you know, a great majority of them, especially for the ones living outside of the city center, have to struggle with, you know, with the everyday bread and butter issues. This then becomes a point of great struggle. And because of that, the easiest avenue of venting frustration is to, of course, look at the migrant population that is in Sabah and sort of lay blame on them, right, for taking the already limited resources that they are afforded away from them, right? But the issue really is, again, if there was a sort of framework that ensured that Sabah, like Sarawak, was able to receive a fair amount of resources and a fair amount of autonomy in deciding how these rightful amount of resources were used by all members of Sabah society, then this would be, I wouldn't say it would solve the issue, but it would certainly be a much more workable problem. Solutions would be, you know, you work towards solutions a lot better. But the mindset is that we've got to survive. And because of this sense of survivalship so strong and the resources are so limited and the opportunities are so limited, you're sort of setting a lot of people up for failure.
This is something that comes up a lot, especially when people in the peninsula talk about Sabah and Sarawak. They're often given as an example of the thing to aspire to when it comes to racial harmony. Mm-hmm. Looking at some of what we've discussed so far, is this true or is this more of a tokenistic way of thinking about it?
I think there is certainly some element of tokenism here, right? Because this sort of tokenism narrative has sort of been instilled into us, ingrained into us from a very young age, right? Something I often tell my students is that the worst word you could actually use is tolerance. And we seem to use a lot of that all the time, right? Tolerate your neighbors, you know, sifat bertoleransi is a thing I grew up with, certainly. But I often kid and say, you know, what if you had a boyfriend and they said, you know, babe, I totally tolerated you. That would be the worst thing you could ever hear. And I think toleration is essentially this idea, this thing where one step beyond toleration, one step to be being beyond tolerant is this whole idea of Sabahan and Sarawakian super laid back sense of racial harmony. Now, I need to really stress here, Sabah, where, you know, I celebrate Indigenous heritage, and, you know, I've got, you know, I've worked very closely with my Sarawakian cousins, I'll call them, and they are one of the most generous people. Certainly incredibly generous by way of what they're willing to give and their understanding of things. And I think this happens very often when you're in the fringes. You know, you've been sidelined so much that you're sort of open to any sort of opportunities that are coming your way. But this generosity is often mistaken and taken for granted as weakness. And I think, you know, this is a problem that we have. While harmonious by way of living, certainly not a non-complicated way of living, there are complexities and issues in Sabah and Sarawak that are often overlooked for much more peninsula-centric problems, right? And therefore, that's why we want to look at the rest of the country through a very peninsula-centric lens. This is a problem. And changing that way of looking at things is an inconvenience. If you want a true, Malaysia Day sense of living, a spirit, then you've got to ensure that that this lens has to be equal by way in which you understand these complexities. So, you know, of course, laid back, yes, very generous people, really incredibly harmonious people, but doing that sort of minimizes the complexities of what they have to live through and with.
We have just a minute left with you. Anything you'd like to leave us with?
Well, you know, I think this, whenever people talk about ME63 and the sort of, you know, the issues around it, is that they always ask, is there a way to really solve this, right? Is there enough political way to will to solve it? And my answer always is not yet, but soon. Because we are now faced and we are now confronted with an entire new generation of Sabahans and Sarawakians who want to be empowered, right? They're looking for ways to address their issues. They become so much more vocal. Social media allows that. But just as, I'm also appreciative of the issue. I'm also appreciative of a reality where there are just as many allies, young allies coming out of the peninsula. And I think that's the best anyone can really hope for. Work towards bridging these gaps and hoping that an entire generation, new generation, come forward and do the things the previous generation cannot.
Dr. Villa, thanks for speaking with us. That was Dr. Vilashini Somia, anthropologist and senior lecturer at University Malaya. Let us know, are you optimistic about Malaysia's direction? Are we living up to our potential? You can call us, you can send us a voice note, you can WhatsApp us and tweet us, and we'll be back for your messages, so keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Bombing frustrated minds, BFM 89.9.
It's 6:38. You're listening to Inside Story with Sharmila and Lynn. And we've been discussing, because of Malaysia Day tomorrow, ME63 and what Malaysia might be like if it was implemented properly. We'd like to hear from you. Send us your thoughts on that. And let us know, are you optimistic about Malaysia's direction? Are we living up to our potential? You can call us 7733 2900. You can send us a voice note at 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. You can WhatsApp us as well. And we are getting plenty of voice notes and messages. But yeah, keep them coming, really.
So I was interested in this idea of whether we're living up to our potential, mostly because it's sort of a referendum. Whenever we talk about the state of our country, and this comes through, you know, across the board, right? Like anything that you start a conversation on, whether it's education or public transportation or the economy, will eventually go towards, well, here's the thing, Malaysia is headed, you know, XYZ direction. And I think that's what I'm curious about, that alongside getting thoughts on ME63, I just want to know, in general, do you feel good about where we are right now? Because I think how we feel about our country will also determine how we feel about almost anything to do with our country, whether it's a new development, whether it's news.
So it's an interesting time to talk about that, right? I mean, what was it? Our ringgit hit the lowest it's been, lowest it's ever been yesterday against the US dollar. We're just coming out of the pandemic. We're facing an election. I think it's an interesting time to talk about potential, because I think when you get stuck in the day-to-day and the endless news cycle of negative news, it can be a little bit difficult to think about what lies ahead and what we want that to look like, which is why we're asking you, really, keep those thoughts coming. Are you optimistic about Malaysia's direction? Are we living up to our potential? You can call us, you can send us a voice note, you can WhatsApp us, you can tweet us. We do have this voice note from Jiamin.
I actually want so much to believe in Malaysia's potential. I think we have so much potential to become a great country. Our culture is so rich and so diverse in itself. I remember having a conversation with a friend one time about moving out of the country, and I felt like so much of our policies didn't extend sufficient rights to minorities in the country. This includes Sabah and Sarawak. And stories like this make me feel so sad about how we've treated them. I hope that there's going to be enough of a push for ME63 to get better recognition and for us to live up to what we can be.
Jiamin, thank you for those thoughts. And, you know, I agree. I think that a big part of moving ahead and getting our potential going, as it were, is actually to recognize that we have multiple different communities, multiple states with differing needs, but we really do need to work for the people most in need as we move forward. We do have a caller on the line. We have Justin. Good evening, Justin. What are your thoughts?
Good evening. My thoughts on ME63, one particular area is really that it should have been implemented long, long time ago, but it didn't happen for whatever reasons that we are not aware of. But for me, for the country to progress and to prosper together, one of the points that we should really look into is the whole idea of equality and treating Sabah and Sarawak as equal partners rather than them being treated as another state within the country. And if we do respect that, then when it comes to all the revenues, they should ideally be getting more than what they are getting today. Because if they are truly partners, equal partners, they should be rewarded as such. And if they do get the kind of revenue, hopefully that will help them really progress and not be seen as two backward states within the country.
Justin, before we let you go, could I just check with you? I mean, we're also asking, right, whether you are optimistic about Malaysia's direction, whether you think as a country we're living up to our potential. What do you think?
Justin, can you hear us? I think we might have lost Justin, but thank you for those thoughts. And, you know, I love the fact that you use the word partners, because that's in fact what MA63 was originally intended to be anyway, for Sabah and Sarawak to be treated as equal partners in the Federation and not as another state.
Yeah, and the other thing, right, that I found interesting is the point about the wealth of Malaysia, because where the source of that wealth is has shifted over time, right? And where the natural bank is of our natural wealth, those are the places in some ways that are now not seeing the kind of development and distribution, again, which is something that we brought up at the start of the show, that we think of when we think of Malaysia's wealth and development.
So, Munif says, here's what puzzles me. The ruling party of half a century are the ones responsible for diminishing the autonomy of the Bornean states. The contract wasn't honoured, and we totally know by who. And yet, every election save the last one has seen the people of said states continuously vote for these so-called culprits. Heck, they are such an asset for their own oppressors that these states are gerrymandered to unfairly tip the balance of general elections in their favour every time. Why? Send the federal government a message where it hurts via your votes.
So we are going to be exploring the politics of Sabah and Sarawak, and specifically how MA63 would have affected that later on in the show. And we are going to ask our guest this question as well, because it's one that comes up a lot, particularly from a Malayan or a Peninsula Malaysia point of view. But I think that there are also some pretty, I mean, even before we get to our guest, right, there are some pretty well-documented reasons as to why this is.
Yeah, and I think a lot of this has to also do with exactly where the problem starts, the othering of Sabah and Sarawak, right? Because largely speaking, many people in Malaysia do tend to vote along community or racial lines. And then on top of that, there's the distance between literal, as in physical distance, but also just distance in terms of understanding needs, understanding practices, culture.
Having communicated in person ever.
Yeah, and I remember even in the last election, there was a lot of criticism about how opposition politicians would show up in Sabah and Sarawak around election time. Nobody would really know who they were, and they were not names that were familiar with them. So, I mean, there is a huge push and pull. I get your point, Munif, but I also think that the situation on the ground really is something that we probably don't understand being here in the peninsula. Anyway, keep those thoughts coming. We are talking about what it would be like if MA63 was properly implemented. And by extension, we're asking you, are you optimistic about Malaysia's direction? Are we living up to our potential? You can call 7733 2900, send us a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be back after this for more of your messages, so keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9. It's 6:47. You're listening to Inside Story with Sharmila and Lynn, and we're discussing MA63 and what it might look like if it was properly, effectively implemented. And we're asking you, are you optimistic about Malaysia's direction? Are we living up to our potential? Call us 7732900, send us a voice note or WhatsApp us 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Let's start with this voice note from Bing.
Well, if MA63 materialized, I think not only in Sabah and Sarawak, but actually in Peninsula as well, we may be able to see, you know, more equal opportunities, better social and economical divergence. I think my experience when I was in the east of Malaysia, it really shows the true nature of being Malaysian. The amount of tolerance among societies and race and religion is commendable. However, what I'm seeing here in Peninsula, it's there's more and more divide than actually an amalgamation and tolerance amongst us, ourselves. So I think, with that happening, you know, that would be a Malaysia, Malaysia.
Bing, thank you for those thoughts. Actually completely agree that having MA63 properly implemented will benefit us as a whole, the whole country. But I mean, definitely specifically Sabah and Sarawak as well. That point about the racial harmony, though, is something that we did discuss earlier with our guest, Dr. Vilashni Somia. And I just wanted to say that I think this is something of a narrative that we hear a lot. And I think there are definitely lessons we can learn from our countrymen in Sabah and Sarawak. But I also fear to use it too often.
Yeah, mostly because as we heard from Dr. Villa earlier, and this is something I've said on air before as well, I think sometimes maybe tolerance isn't my personal benchmark. But otherwise, I 100% agree. And I think that there is absolutely... Earlier, Dr. Villa described that feeling that that might happen when a person who has never previously left Sabah or Sarawak visit Peninsula Malaysia and recognize the disparity in terms of development and think to themselves, well, what the heck? You know, what is this? And I think the reverse does happen of someone who has never left the peninsula, heading over to Sabah or Sarawak, sitting in a coffee shop and going, well, what the heck? You know, I haven't seen this either. And I think this constant sharing of this narrative is actually just part and parcel of the fact that some of us don't know each other very well, in that we've not really visited these states on either side of the, well, on either side of the sea.
The sea, literally. Yeah. Patrick says, let's go back to 1977, the Form 3 National Secondary School LCE exam in Sabah. As a Sabahan, I felt cheated because there was, I believe, a conspiracy of some sort by the Federal Ministry of Education when they implemented BM as a compulsory subject to pass in the 1977 LCE exam. In the 11th hour, when the year 1977 was the last year of English medium of instruction, many Sabahan students lost the opportunity to progress to Form 4 because they didn't get a pass in the BM paper, oral or written. Many had to drop out of school, even though many had done well in other subjects. Was there a breach of MA63?
I mean, Patrick, sorry that that happened to you. I would imagine, I would feel cheated too, and I think it's tough enough taking exams at the best of times. And yeah, I mean, this is something that we covered earlier as well, right? The fact that you see a prioritization of language and culture in a very particular way. And on the one hand, you can talk about it from a cultural perspective. On the flip side of that, what you're describing in education, right, as a student, is not abstract or you know, philosophical at all. It had a direct impact on people's lives. And yeah, I mean, I'm sorry. I wish that it had been done better. I don't know what else to say.
We have a couple of people making points about the incredible resources that are available in Sabah and Sarawak, right? So Mohan simply saying Borneo would have been a powerhouse. Mm. Nesh, meanwhile, says 60% of Malaysia's landmass is in Borneo. Sarawak alone is 97% the size of Peninsula Malaysia. Yet when it comes to wealth distribution, it's lacking. Did Singapore win the lottery?
Right or not? Sometimes you it's hard, right? When you're comparing something like the Federation of Malaysia and you have both Sarawak and Singapore in the mix, and you think to yourself, well, how does this work? Okay, If we look back, though, to the point about whether we're living up to our potential, we've got a few. So Edwin says, we are definitely not living up to the potential of Malaysia. The Malaysia Federation was one coined by the late Lee Kuan Yew, whether Malaysians like it or not, that's historical fact. The economic potential, the people and development, it was all marred by racial politics, which was not the idea of what Malaysia was supposed to be. If we were to put that rhetoric away, since the inception of the Federation, I've no doubt that Malaysia would have reached or surpassed the economy of Germany today.
You know, I feel like often when I hear of these comparisons, there are multiple things, right? On the one hand, Germany has had a lot more time to get to where it is today. But I think that we've definitely not helped ourselves in terms of, particularly when we talk about resources. And when you're a kid, you get told this a lot in school, that Malaysia is rich with natural resources. And yet as you get older, you also realize how much of that has actually been misused, squandered. And you think, how much more could we have been?
I'm thinking whether or not it's accurate to say Germany had more time. Because
That's true, actually. Yes. Post-World War II is yeah, you're right.
Because the comparisons that often come are Germany and Japan, and neither of them had that many more decades than we did, right? It's a matter of what are we talking about? 15 years, maybe. So, at most. And so, I do feel the comparison is apt, and I say this mostly to depress myself. I wish I was not saying this. As you were saying it, I'm like, yeah, maybe I should just...
Here I was trying not to say Singapore. And then you just stomped all over my what I thought the point I was making. But yeah, I take it back, I think.
No, because I do feel sometimes quite upset when I think about Germany and Japan and the ways in which they emerged as post-war powerhouses, right, in terms of the economy, admittedly with some social... with some social pitfalls and downfalls. No one's denying that. But yeah, unfortunately, yeah, Germany is depressing. We also have this from Ineza, who says, as a queer person, it's hard to feel like Malaysia isn't going downhill with the constant discrimination and hate being spouted by leaders on all sides against LGBTs. How we treat our most marginalized is the true reflection of our progress. And that last sentence in particular is one that I think about an awful lot.
I think about it a lot. I agree with it 100%. It's that phrase that always gives me pause. We are only as good as how we treat our most marginalized. And at the moment, I don't think we could speak that well of ourselves in that regard. Very quickly, I think we have time for this voice note from Vijay.
Definitely not optimistic at all. And that's because the politicians are not living it, not allowing us to live to our potentials.
Vijay, thank you for that. I think short, but very to the point.
There was someone else who brought up Rachna saying, oh no, sorry. The issue of corruption in government, right? So Rachna saying Malaysia would reach its potential if corruption in government is rooted out. We could have been much more like, here we go, Germany or Japan, if there wasn't a hole in the bucket. I'm telling you, it's hard. I wish we could say that we were like left behind, but you know.
Well, a couple of people bringing up other points that I think have been kind of a conversation starter, or conversation depressor, shall I say. Mar saying, how can we be living up to our potential when the talent pool is leaving the nation? Also, the policy and special treatments for only one group of population creates a power imbalance moving forward. The population is increasing, but our living for the middle class is still tough. Yet do I have a choice but to be optimistic?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's how a lot of people feel, right? Like, especially if you are choosing to stay, then just, you know, what else do you have to do? I do want to look at this one from Anon, who says, as a Sarawakian, I think the current government's efforts to honour MA63 is laudable. There's also an increased awareness among Malaysians, particularly the younger generation, of the aspirations and visions of MA63. While I remain optimistic, there is, however, much to be done. It's not a matter of putting lip service to the agreement, but it's really about genuinely celebrating our oneness as a nation despite our differences. Answering Munif's assertions re the elections. When you do not have access to the right infrastructure and information, and when putting food on your plate is the main priority, I think voting for the devil you know is better than voting for the devil you don't. It's easy to put an urbanized, or dare I say it, Malayan lens to this polemic, but you really need to be in our shoes at our longhouses to see why we vote the way we vote. If all the voters is the Parti Pemerintah. They're the ones that hand out subsidies and developments and provide basic infrastructure and so on. What is the incentive to vote for the Parti Penyakal, literally liars, in the elections? Because they don't know you and you're there only during elections.
Anonymous, thank you for that. You put much better the point that I was trying to arrive at earlier as well, which is that this is something that we in the peninsula are guilty of doing a little too often, I think. Sort of bagging on Sarawak and Sabah voters when it comes election time and it doesn't necessarily go the way you wanted it to go, without, I think, talking enough about the actual social, economic...
Lived experiences
that happen in the States.
I was very intrigued by this from Kamarun Nizam, who says, if MA63 were implemented properly, we would have been like the United Kingdom. We would have England, Scotland, Wales. And then if we look at it that way, England is Peninsular Malaysia. We truly learn from our penjajah.
Oh.
That's a good context.
That is a good context. I mean...
The insistence on staying also.
The insistence on staying. And, you know, this is something earlier, Dr. Villa said how you would be mind blown if you think of, say, Kuching and the context of Perlis and how that might function, right? This is also mind-blowing to me in a way, because I think thinking of Sabah and Sarawak within the context of how the United Kingdom might function gives us a very useful way of discussing what it might be. Very quickly, Vicky says, the indigenous people of Malaya, Sabah and Sarawak get the short end of the stick versus political elites of both East and West Malaysia.
I think that's absolutely true.
Keep those thoughts coming. We are talking about MA63 and what it might be like if it was implemented properly. Let us know, are you optimistic about Malaysia's direction? Are we living up to our potential? You can call 7733 2900, send us a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio, and we'll be back after this for more of your messages. So keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Break from mediocrity. BFM 89.9.
Good evening. You're with Sharmila and Lynn. We're continuing our conversation about Malaysia Day, now by looking at how the politics of Sabah and Sarawak and our country as a whole would be different if MA63 had been implemented properly.
And then on Popcorn Culture, our supercut tonight is focused on gods and myths on screen. Tell us your favourites.
And keep those thoughts coming. Are you optimistic about Malaysia's direction? Are we living up to our potential? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp, or send us a voice note 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. All this coming your way on Inside Story. It's 7:07. You're listening to Inside Story with Sharmila and Lynn. And on the occasion of Malaysia Day tomorrow, we're talking about MA63 and what it could have looked like if implemented properly. We're also asking you, are you optimistic about Malaysia's direction? Are we living up to our potential? We're getting plenty of thoughts, plenty of voice notes. You can call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp, send us a voice note 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Let's start with a voice note from Hannah.
I don't know, it's hard to be optimistic about Malaysia's history. I mean, obviously, as a Malaysian, you love your country. But sometimes when you compare with other countries around you, especially in the Asian region, and you see how far they're progressing, it's a bit frustrating, especially when you know that we have countries like Sabah and Sarawak who haven't been given the equal treatment or the opportunity to flourish, like maybe other states, like Selangor and KL especially. So I am hopeful, but a part of me also feels like nothing is going to change, especially since the movement with the MA63 agreement is going so slowly.
Hannah, thank you for your thoughts. You know, if it helps, the comparing to other countries in the region is something that really can be quite a lot to think about. And that's coming through in the messages as well.
So I wanted to follow or pick up on some threads of conversation that started in the 6 o'clock hour. So one of which was sent earlier on by about exam papers and language. So Pat says, sufficient time should have been given for weaker students to be better prepared to take on the BM paper, as we had been studying in English from day one. It felt very unfair and unreasonable, even up till today. After so many years, the ministry, the federal government or Ministry of Education did. So not everyone had the chance to continue their studies in expensive private schools. Many more Sabahans could have been professionals. Clearly, MA63 was not completely honoured. Hari ini dalam sejarah, followed by, as usual, BFM will ignore this. Pat, I'm not sure what we did to give you that impression, but I hope, I don't know actually, I hope that reading that out helped. I think that this was something that was brought up earlier on by another listener, right? The issue of having to suddenly do the exam in Bahasa, having learned only in English and not having had that preparation time. And, you know, honestly, if I had undergone that, I would absolutely still feel this way as well.
So the previous listener, Patrick, I believe, talked about how they thought this was a sort of a concerted effort or some kind of a conspiracy, right? But I think even if you don't look at it that way, there is the issue of not consulting with the people who are going to be impacted by something like this before making a policy change like this, which clearly has wide-ranging impacts. We have Amirul saying, Malaysia is a fairly young country. Malaya gained independence 65 years ago. Malaysia was fully formed 59 years ago. Germany and Japan are rich in history. They were involved in World War. They being involved in World War II showed how much power they had back then. Germany itself was among the center of the Renaissance and Enlightenment era. Japan has a long, rich history as way back as 500 CE. Malaya was under subjugation from the Siamese, Portuguese, Dutch, and the British. My point is, we still have a long way to go. Also, to give a different perspective, the whole MA63 is the equivalent to the current issue of Scotland finding independence from the English. Literally the same issue. Not quite sure I agree with you there on that, Amirul, about the Scotland-British part. On Malaysia having a long way to go, I agree. However, I think, you know, Lynn, I'll let you explain the equivalence to Germany and Japan earlier.
Well, I think what we were speaking about earlier was the fact that Germany and Japan, when they began this pathway, right, from post-war times,
efforts,
basically, to now, they were starting at a deficit. So I take your point that they were countries that already had a very rich history of innovation and I guess a background of wealth. But at the point that we're talking about, they were really starting from less than where they were.
And I think the thing is also, if we talk about comparisons, there are closer comparisons to be had as well. So CG, for example, saying, don't compare us to Japan or Germany, compare us with Korea. Our car industry started at the same time, but where is the Korean car industry compared to Proton or Produa? Malunya.
I mean, CG, you're not alone in bringing up Korea. There's also Anonymous who says, it's really paradoxical that some of our politicians who do not enjoy preferential citizen rights didn't uphold fairness and equality. That's why I don't see much choice for genuine leaders when GE comes around. We've been left behind by South Korea. Now Vietnam and Indonesia are going to overtake us. Everybody is just throwing in names for countries that they're expecting to overtake Malaysia.
So going back to the question of MA63, we're still getting a number of people making points. Mohan says, hashtag reinstate MA63. I'm here in KK at my condo car park listening to this topic still. Appreciate that. That shows how important this topic is. I'm a Peninsular Malaysian, but in KK, I feel how the folks living in Borneo feel.
Yeah, thank you so much for listening. And also, by the by, if you're not in the Klang Valley, you can listen to us online or on our app. Just a quick plug.
Don't have to sit in a car park.
Mohan, you set me up. So it was there to be said.
And we also have Bunga Melayu on Twitter saying, I'm from KL and I believe since 1963, Sabah and Sarawak have been under new colonization. They're deprived of so many basic needs while having their resources stolen and manipulated. I sometimes hope that the people of Sabah and Sarawak would fight for their true independence and fulfill their true potential.
And therein, I think we go back to Amirul's point earlier about Scotland. So, yeah, I see the parallels.
And just to close off, I think, and this is something that comes up quite a bit when we talk about equality, I suppose. A couple of people, CG, saying equal partner, let them have a chance to be PM. Zafir on Twitter, meanwhile, says, why not rotate our PM between the territories? Something that, in fact, representatives and politicians from Sabah and Sarawak have been calling for quite a long time. Keep those thoughts coming. We are going to continue our conversation after this on how in the implementation of MA63 might have shaped our politics. But let us know as well, are you optimistic about Malaysia's direction? Are we living up to our potential? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp, or send us a voice note at 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be joined after this by Arif Adiputra, Research Officer at the Institute for Development Studies in Sabah. So keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9. It's 7:15. You're listening to Inside Story with Sharmila and Lynn, and we're closing off our conversation about MA63 and its proper implementation by discussing how that might shape our political landscape, both for Sabah and Sarawak as well as the rest of the country. But keep those thoughts coming. Are you optimistic about Malaysia's direction? Are we living up to our potential? You can call us, you can WhatsApp us, you can send us a voice note, you can tweet us as well. Joining us now is Arif Adiputra, Research Officer at the Institute for Development Studies in Sabah. Arif, thanks for speaking with us today.
Hi, good evening. Happy to be here.
Could you start by explaining how much autonomy Sabah and Sarawak state governments currently have and how that plays out?
Well, most of the autonomy that's stipulated for the Sabah and Sarawak state government is listed under the state list, which is under the 9th schedule of the federal constitution, where the state government has administrative jurisdictions such as land, agriculture, forestry, local government, and things of a local character. Also, you have things such as state works and water, alongside native law and customs, including personal laws relating to marriage, divorce, inheritance, and so on and so forth. There's a long list, but I recommend everyone to take a look there. It's a very extensive list of rights that are granted to both Sabah and Sarawak. But you also have the concurrent list, which are certain aspects of governance, which are shared between both the federal government and the state government. These are things such as public health, national parks, irrigation, town and country planning.
And what historical roots have created this relationship?
Well, the idea why we would have these certain special rights granted towards Sabah and Sarawak is that during the whole formation of Malaysia, there were causes of concerns of whether or not the local character, especially the indigenous and native character of both Sabah and Sarawak should be will be preserved, and whether or not the interests of the Sabahan and Sarawakian people, as it transitions to merging with the Federation of Malaya to form Malaysia, would be maintained. But this is always the negotiation that was happening back and forth during the time when we, especially in Sabah's situation, we had a lot of the local leaders, the tribal local leaders, that was facilitated by the British, who were also embarking on the decolonial experience. They met up and decided that we have certain lists of demands here that if should you agree to it, we'll be okay with joining up with Malaya to form this country called Malaysia. So that was enshrined for Sarawak in the 18 points, and for Sabah, it was the 20 points agreement. So these 18 points and 20 points documents were later incorporated into the federal constitution itself, which is where we have the state list.
So in relation to our next question, we do have this voice note from a listener. This is Madi.
This is Madi. In the case of Sabah and Sarawak, I don't think that they should be asking for 30% power base, because there are two entities, no doubt, out of the three entities in Malaysia, but they should be asking for need base. They are underdeveloped and they have resources. So in terms of economic development, they want the 30% development or the development budget. We can look at it. But in terms of population, they are very small compared to peninsula. So if we give them a power base of that, then one vote to one citizen is not equal base between the three territories.
Thank you for that, Madi. Arif, just to pick up on that point about the 30% requested allocation. So at the moment, Sabah and Sarawak make up only 25% of seats in parliament. What was the intended allocation under MA63, and what impact would larger East Malaysian representation have had as a whole on our political landscape?
Well, the idea was when the federation was formed, we had 156 originally. Singapore had 15, Sabah had 16, which is now 25. Sarawak had 24, which is now 31. So we can see for Sabah and Sarawak, we only had an increase of at least 7 parliamentary seats since 1963. However, when we look at the idea of population numbers as a justification to delineate and expand more parliamentary seats. In my humble opinion, we have to also look into the geographic composition of both Sabah and Sarawak, because the population is very widespread. It's very sparse. It's very spread out. So you would have certain parliamentary seats and districts which are almost, can cover at least five districts in itself. Like if you look at the parliamentary seat of Pensiangan or Kinabatangan, these are very, very massive seats with a lot of pockets of rural settlements here and there, which are very difficult to reach, especially when it comes to development. So if we are to use population as justification, it's not able for decision makers or parliamentarians to be able to service communities which are very sparsely populated, which are very widespread, dotted here and there. But we also have to note that when Singapore exited the federation, there was this argument that those 15 seats should have been reallocated back to Sabah and Sarawak, which it wasn't, because where would those seats go? It would be mostly a transfer of more power towards the peninsula states. But in terms of what impact it would have if that was to be the case, if Sabah and Sarawak's seats were expanded, it would at least have more agency in terms of voting powers within the parliamentary sessions, because we have had instances where we would have certain acts, such as the Petroleum Development Act, which was passed, and inevitably it was considered a long-term detriment to Sabah and Sarawak, and I think for Kelantan and Terengganu as well, a detriment to their long-term stability and economic health. But if we were to have more representation, it would allow more issues that are Sabahan and Sarawakian in character to be part of a national conversation. We have issues such as the long-standing idea of oil royalties. So if there were more voices to be heard, that would apply more pressure for the federal government to actually step up and do something about it.
And so that's in terms of issues, right? But if we look at political parties and dynamics, how might that look? Would we see the same parties and people in power?
I think for at least Sabah and Sarawak's case, we would largely see many individuals and politicians still being either in power or still hold quite a substantial position and respect within the population. Because if we were to look at the political landscape of Sabah especially, we could see that it is very personality-based. It's almost akin to almost like a remnant of a more tribal era, where we would look towards village chiefs as the ones that would provide sustenance and assistance towards the tribe itself. So that has bled into the idea of personality politics. So if the idea of MA63 is brought to as in the form of rhetoric, you could easily say that, okay, this individual, this politician, is fighting for something, an idea of rights that has been stolen and is trying to fight for it back. So that just adds more prestige and adds more credibility to that certain politician. And many politicians in Sabah has already been doing this in terms of we need to fight for our rights, we need to get back what was lost to us as a way to expand their political mileage. But if it was to shift, if let's say MA63 is to be implemented now in its entirety, then you could see that kind of transference of prestige towards whichever party or government of the day. You would see an increase in popularity, because they are able to say that we've managed to fight for our rights after many, many years of being neglected and many, many years of rights being slowly eroded over time. That adds more prestige. It adds almost like a hero-like imagery to the local population, because if you're able to fight for something, then that just says that this might be the leader that I can put my trust in moving forward from here. But that may not necessarily be the case. Like we can see in other countries where revolutionaries don't necessarily make the best transitions towards administrators.
How about when it comes to managing both the state and country finances? How do you think discussions and allocations during budget would be different if Sabah and Sarawak were given more equity?
I think when it comes to budget allocation, because when we look at the state list and things that were promised under MA63, not many of these aspects has something where it generates income and revenue for Sabah and Sarawak is the benefit of natural resources such as oil and gas. So that is one resource that is very attractive and very lucrative. It's a very big industry that has been slowly eroded, and agency from Sabah and Sarawak has been taken away when it comes to managing their oil and gas resources. So that is why we have the whole conversation of how the state governments are reliant on budgetary allocations from the federal government. So if MA63 is to be implemented, then I would say, in my opinion, that the allocation would still remain the same. These conversations still remain the same, because the income generating aspect of certain rights has already been taken away. And most of it is just under the idea of administration and not the management of resources per se, other than maybe, let's say, mining, quarrying, and other types of natural resources. But however, it has to be said still that many of Sabah's, Sarawak's income in terms of state generation still comes from agriculture and tourism.
So there has been a strong theme emerging throughout our show today, brought up by listeners primarily, pointing out that Sabah and Sarawak are traditionally viewed as Barisan national strongholds come the general elections. What are the circumstances that have led to this, and do you see it continuing?
How we got to this point, where Sabah and Sarawak are seen as this bastion for Barisan national support, is that we had this whole historical undercurrent of whereby the federal governments had certain machinations for the Sabah state and the Sarawakian state, where they applied the same rules such as the British Empire, where they would divide and conquer. They would see that certain leaders, because most of Sabahan leaders weren't naturally united as well. Of course, they fought together to be able to bring up these points. However, they had their own personality issue. They have their own idiosyncrasies and their own eccentric personalities. And they would tend to butt heads with each other. They were never really on a united front. So you would see a lot of local political parties split up, break up, and form new ones to challenge the status quo. And this was seen as an opportune moment for especially UMNO to penetrate into Sabah, and especially Sabah. It was until that whole wave of this whole nationalist fervor during the 80s and 90s that local parties that wasn't backed by Barisan Nasional and UMNO were able to take back and arrest control back from UMNO itself and prevent that spread. However, that also fell to just the resources that the federal parties were able to mobilize in such force that it's able to just overwhelm the local political parties and reducing them to almost a vassal, almost like a vassals type relationship towards the political parties in the peninsula. But how I would see this continue is that we've already seen many local political parties become a bit more aggressive, a bit more assertive in how they would like to fight for Sabah, how they would like the restoration of Sabah's and Sarawak's rights, especially when we look at GPS in Sarawak. Even though they are allied with the government of the day currently, they are still able to articulate themselves because they're able to mobilize enough unity in terms of numbers and the seats to be able to demand and say that this is what we would want, this is what we need. And I think the symbolic gesture that encapsulates Sarawak's perfect articulation of that is when they changed the head of the state to the title of premier. But for Sabah, that type of unity is still still in its genesis, really. There's still not that type of mass mobilization of support that's united for the sole reason of counteracting federal influence. So I would say that there may still be pockets of resistance within Sabah, but I think in Sarawak, much of that has already been slowly eroded, and we see a more Sarawakian identity, politically speaking, coming out from there. But for Sabah, I still believe it's a half and half kind of journey. It was halfway there still.
Arif, thanks for speaking with us today.
All right, thank you so much.
That was Arif Adiputra, Research Officer at the Institute for Development Studies in Sabah, weighing in on how proper implementation of the MA63 might shift our political landscape. Let us know, are you optimistic about Malaysia's direction? Are we living up to our potential? You can call 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp or send us a voice note, 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.